Hey, my name is Ray Wayne Gonzalez. Join me on my journey out of ignorance with Things You Pretend to Know About, where we talk about things we think we may know, but really we have no idea. We don't have a clue. Welcome to the Things You Pretend to Know About podcast, or welcome back to the Things You Pretend to Know About podcast. Today on the show, we have civil rights lawyer Janos Martin, who happens to be running for the district attorney of the borough of Manhattan. His election is next spring, but I wanted this episode out as soon as possible. This being because we're all screaming, defund the police, abolish the police, but how is that possible? Well, Janos has a plan for this. He also explained so many things that I didn't really know about, and I can imagine that a lot of you might be pretending to know, too. For people listening right now, when it's not June and the year is not 2020, a quick reminder if you forgot. Since March 2020, America and most of the world has been stuck inside due to a global pandemic. I'll never forget this time of my life. Okay, so we've been stuck inside with a global pandemic, but after the murder of George Floyd, all of us came outside. More, a lot of us came outside. And this was because we came out in big groups to fight against racial injustices and for civil rights in solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement. I think a lot of us are hurting right now, and I know a lot of us are exhausted, especially the Black community who has been fighting this fight all their lives. But maybe I'm optimistic. I do have hope. Things are already changing as we speak due to these protests, peaceful or not. I hope this episode inspires you like it did me. Okay. Well, stay safe out there and pace yourself. Okay, thank you. I love you all so, so much. Okay, bye. Things you pretend to know about. Things you pretend to know. Things you pretend to know about. Things you pretend to know. All right. Cool. So hello, we're recording. So I'm here with, do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. This is Janos Martin. I'm a civil rights attorney in Manhattan, New York, and I'm running for district attorney next year.
Very cool. So what made you want to run for district attorney?
Well, I've been working to reform the criminal justice system basically my whole career as an organizer before law school, as a civil rights lawyer. I ran a campaign, Closed Rikers. You see the banner in the background, an effort to close the most notorious jail in New York. And I've worked at the ACLU. So I've tried to fix what's broken about our criminal justice system the best I can for many years. And with everything that's been going on the last 2 weeks, I'm glad so many Americans are tuning into what's broken about our policing and our jail and our prosecutorial system. And district attorney is an office that can make huge changes in how the criminal justice system works on a day-to-day basis. And so I realized that running for Manhattan DA and making the changes from within that office would be a way to really give a lot more people a second chance and stop our society's use of jail and prison to solve so many of our problems.
Yes, 100%. Yeah, I got a little lippy to my followers because I was saying I told them to ask me their questions. And I see so many people, myself included, you know, fighting defund the police, fighting we abolish the police and fight, you know, for racial equality. And then no one had questions. It's like, hello, this is someone that can make change potentially, you know? So I actually got a lot of questions the second time. I was like, I don't know if you heard me. And so can you explain what a district attorney does exactly? Because I think that was why people were hesitant to ask questions, because they weren't really sure.
That's absolutely fair. And a big part of this campaign is educating the community on the role that they can play in electing district attorneys, not only in Manhattan, but all over the country. I remember one of the first campaign events I did was hosted by some friends from college. And I gave my whole speech and I was like, do you have any questions? And literally the first question is, wait, so what exactly does the DA do? And so if people are not sure, this is common. I mean, the reality is that district attorneys exist in every county in the United States, but very often they don't run in competitive elections. So people don't really get to learn about what a DA does. So a district attorney is basically in charge of administering justice. They're the lead law enforcement officer in their jurisdiction, which is usually in the United States by county. So in Manhattan, it's New York County. And what that means is anytime the police arrest somebody, people are familiar with the idea of a person getting charged. Well, the district attorney is the office that charges a person, gets to argue whether or not they should be held in jail before their trial, takes them to trial or makes a plea bargain with them or dismisses their case. The district attorney has a lot of say in whether a person can do an alternative to incarceration instead of going to jail or prison. And then, you know, if somebody has done something really harmful, the district attorney's office ultimately figures out what punishment they want to seek on behalf of the state. And that could be prison time. And so they have a lot of say in sort of how long that prison sentence might be. So really from the police are the step one, right, the point of arrest. But really all the steps that come after that, the district attorney's office has a really big say in sort of what direction a case takes. And so for me as a career civil rights lawyer, it's important to come up with ideas where, okay, somebody may or may not have committed harm. What is a way that we can address this issue in a way that's holistic, that gets a person's life back on track, that offers some kind of resolution to the victim? And can we do that without involving jail and prison? That's basically what my campaign's about. But in terms of what the district attorney does, they have a lot of discretion at each little step along the way about what direction a case takes.
Okay. So yeah, that explained it very well for me. So do you have, as a district attorney, would you have any control of like the NYPD or any like, or no, who does that go under? Because
that's a great question, especially right now. Police are usually controlled by the mayor, right? Because they report to a police commissioner, and in most jurisdictions, including New York City, the police commissioner is answers to the mayor. Okay. So the district attorney's office doesn't have direct control, direct supervision over police, but there's a big role that district attorneys can play. First of all, if a district attorney is not going to prosecute a certain type of case, they can convey that to the police, and the police can still choose to arrest somebody, but they'll know that on the other end, a person is, you know, not going to be prosecuted. So an example from the protest, right, is, you know, a lot of people successfully pushed the incoming Manhattan DA to not prosecute protesters for nonviolent protests. And some other DAs around the country are doing the same, San Francisco, for example. Mm-hmm. And I've talked about, even before the context of these protests, that, you know, we would not prosecute for sex crimes, for sex workers, for example, who are just trying to make a living. We're not going to prosecute people for drug possession, for any drug, including marijuana and more serious drugs, because sending somebody to jail or prison for drug possession is not the answer. So
yeah,
that the distinction there is the police still can arrest somebody, but we can say we're not going to prosecute that. The second thing the DAs can do with respect to police is hold them accountable. So if a police officer engages in violence against people that is clearly outside the scope of their job, they can be charged with assault or any other type of offense that relates to what they did. And importantly, if a police officer lies on the stands about what they did or what happened in an arrest, you know, that's perjury. You can technically prosecute someone for that. And that happens very infrequently now. But I think moving forward, I think a lot of people have seen in the news and in the videos that police aren't always truthful in how they represent a situation. And I think one way to hold police accountable for that is to say, look, if you lie on the stand, you may be prosecuted for perjury.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that's just, you know, liquid gold to a lot of our ears because that's just what we've been wanting to hear. How do you feel about the defund the police and abolish the police? When I first heard about that, I was like, that's never going to happen. That's just like never possible. And then it was more explained to me. I mean, not that I didn't agree with it, it's just that I have so little faith in our government, honestly, as a millennial, young millennial, that any good change would happen. And, you know, I'm a Bernie person. Like I'm, you know, I have so much hope in grassroots movement, but I've never seen it come to fruition. But I feel like now things are slowly changing. I heard Minnesota has made, I heard de Blasio actually made a commitment to kind of defunding the police in a way, but I also don't trust it. Right. I don't know.
Well, first of all, I'm a Bernie person as well. So certainly glad to hear that. I think we are at a very transformative moment. I'm really excited. You know, I was just at a rally this morning. It was a morning rally because we're reopening here in New York. And so the organizers really wanted to send the message that even though we're reopening, we're going to keep the protests going. And it was funny. It was like doing a protest at 9 a.m. is like going to the gym early. You know, it's like, I feel like I've done my protesting for the day already.
Your day, yeah.
You know, we were talking about this at the rally. And you know, one of the things this is about is about how we prioritize resources for our community. And right now, post-COVID, a lot of budgets are really struggling, right? In New York, we have something like a $7 billion budget deficit. So the question is, are we going to keep spending $6 billion a year on police when we can't fund our after-school programs, we can't fund our mental health programs, we can't fund our youth job programs? And so that's, to me, defund means different things to different people. For me, it means it's not fair, it's not just to eliminate all these programs that help the community while we're funding the police. And right. So the police need to take a serious budget cut. In New York, we're talking about $1 billion and having that money reallocated to other things.
Yeah.
And then what you mentioned with Minneapolis, you know, that's really amazing. And we're all sort of watching to see what comes next. But here, you know, the NYPD was founded in 1845, and they've had problems pretty much ever since, you know, whether it's corruption or violence or mismanagement or, you know, issues of racism. So after 180 years or whatever, you have to ask, like, is this really working? And so I think the idea of what Minneapolis is doing, which is starting over with a different system, mm-hmm. is really appealing to me. And I don't think we're going to get there in the next few weeks. This is Freya. I don't think we're going to get there in the next few weeks here in New York, but I think in the next couple of weeks, we can definitely get to a place where we cut the NYPD budget by $1 billion or more and just take it from there.
Yeah. Honestly, if I'm being vulnerable and transparent, I have had a tough time with not defund the police or abolish the police, but the all cops are bad at first, because I didn't, I'd like to think I am a critical thinker, right? But I mean, I have family, close family who are NYPD. I have a family member who's a lawyer for the NYPD, and I have a neighbor who's NYPD. And all I know them as great people, but what I have learned and, you know, developed through much, you know, research is that it's not about your uncle. You know what I mean? It's not like uncle. It's about the system that has taken place. And I think defunding the police directly correlates to the all cops are quote unquote bastards or all cops are bad. But yeah, I'm going to reference some of the questions that I've gotten.
Wait, can I just say a quick one on that?
Yeah, please.
Yeah, you know, another element of defunding the police, which I think speaks to, you know, your experience knowing good people who go into the police force. We as a society over the last number of decades have asked the police to do more and more things, and including things that I don't think they're well suited for. So when you talk about people saying get police out of schools, right? I mean, I went to both, you know, a lower income school and a very high end high school. And, you know, in fancy public schools or fancy private schools, you don't have police in the hallway. You don't have metal detectors, right? So the idea there, justice is getting people who go to those lower income schools the same kinds of rights and same kind of liberties that people have in upper income schools. When you talk about people who have mental health issues, maybe social workers who are trained on how to deal with those problems are better suited to talk to people than police with guns on their belts. When you're talking about, you know, having people in the subway who are homeless, having police go in and clear them out is only going to cause problems for everybody. So I think as a society, we've piled more and more things onto what a police officer is supposed to do. And that's one of the reasons police budgets are so expensive. And so when we say defund the police, part of it is just getting the police out of these systems like schools, like people with mental health issues, like people experiencing homelessness, and having people who are better suited, better prepared to deal with those issues.
Absolutely. And I fully agree with that. My family who's NYPD is Puerto Rican. So it's like, well, you know, they're not bad because they're Puerto Rican, you know what I mean? But I fully have a grasp of everything that's going on now. And, you know, I try to be as progressive as possible, and I fully agree with everything you're saying. So I've gotten a lot of questions. I have a friend actually who is from Minnesota near Minneapolis, and she had a lot of questions for me. She said, I don't know how to structure this question, but I would like to know about your opinion on our systematic reliance on bail for nonviolent offenders awaiting trial. A huge portion of prison populations are people who cannot afford bail, and so they wait for their trial in jail. And that's incredibly fucked. And I agree.
Yes. So it's a great question. It's a huge problem all around the country. I'll say this, you know, in the beginning of 2016, I co-founded the Close Rikers campaign, and the mission there was to close the largest jail complex in New York and do that by significantly reducing the number of people we have in jail. And in New York City, when we started our campaign, there were about 10,000 people in jail on a nightly basis, and about 3/4 of them were people who were there pre-trial because they couldn't afford to pay bail. So that was a huge problem in New York. What we did is we spent 4 years fighting to change the bail laws, and we now have a bail law in New York where for most misdemeanors and nonviolent felonies, you cannot have bail assigned.
Okay.
So that problem that your friend talked about, fortunately, is on the way out in New York. And that's that's a great thing. It's cut our jail population almost in half. You know, until recently, now there's like hundreds of protesters in jail. But before that, we had our jail cells were at their lowest level since the 1950s here in New York. And a lot of that was because we changed the way we did bail. So I highly encourage people all over the country. You probably have somebody in your state working on bail reform. It's so important, because I completely agree. As somebody running for district attorney, I think it is not morally just, and it's frankly not really in line with our constitutional values to keep somebody in jail before the state has proven their guilt. You know, there's an exceptional set of cases where we think, you know, a person might be at risk of harming another person, but in most cases, I think a person should be able to fight their case from home until they have their day in court.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's ridiculous that protesters are getting. How do you feel about the curfews? And this is my question. How do you feel about the curfews? It feels like a way for, honestly, the police to incite violence. And it's just, I mean, I know they got rid of the curfew just the other day, but how did you feel about that? What was your first initial thought?
It's crazy. You know, I think it's tramples on our First Amendment rights. I don't think there was really a basis for it, certainly not after the first night or two. And I'm glad they got rid of it. But we haven't had a curfew in New York since World War II. And I think that's for a reason. I think New Yorkers especially, I mean, this is not a city that really respects going home at 8 p.m., you know? And think of the impact it had on all these small businesses that are desperately trying to get back on their feet after COVID. I thought it was a terrible decision. And you're totally right. It created a whole new pretext for police officers to go after people. Right? Oh, it's 8:01. Now we get to arrest you. And that's exactly what happened, by the way, in the Bronx especially. And so I'm glad the curfew's over. I hope we never do that again. And, you know, I hope other cities get out from under their curfews too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, it was crazy because I'm from a small town that's predominantly white. And then I've lived in New York City for about 3-4 years. I'm not sure. And I was home because of the pandemic, and I got to talking to my neighbor, and he was infuriated about, you know, his windows got knocked in, and it was hard not to feel empathy for him. But also on the other hand, I'm with the protesters, and I don't see any of my friends or you know, acquaintances inciting any violence. And so, and I think a lot of people are grouping them into protesters, looters, quote unquote, and like, you know, I don't know, but I came in form words because it's hard to say, and I don't really even know about the looters versus the rioters. And I totally backed the rioters in Minneapolis, but now I'm like, are people just taking advantage of everything? It is like, I can't wrap my head around it, because I've been to a few protests myself and it's been completely peaceful. Mm-hmm. But again, I have left before curfew.
Well, yeah, I think at least in New York, the protests the last couple of days have been pretty incident free as far as protesters doing anything wrong. You know, yeah. There have been individual instances of police instigating things, but we're sort of past the worst patch of things now, where we did have windows and shops being broken into. And to your point about the curfew, I feel like if people were actually in their businesses able to stay open, we'd have a lot less vandalism, right? Vandalism generally happens when you've got abandoned streets. And
That's true.
Hopefully we'll be good moving forward. You know, usually, and this is one of the things that makes this moment different. You know, people keep asking, you know, is this different than past moments, past protests? And what I've seen before is that when you have really angry protests over a police killing or some other act of injustice, it'll be really hot for a couple of days, and then people go back to their lives, right? I mean, but what's amazing is that this is now, you know, Saturday, Sunday was the second weekend. So we're talking days 10, 11, 12 of these protests, and people are still going stronger than ever. Saturday was, I think, the most people I've seen out in New York since the Iraq War protests. So we're just keeping, you know, the momentum is going, and you get the sense that people are not going to stop until they get actual changes. You mentioned Bill de Blasio before. De Blasio promised to move money around, but he didn't give a number. He didn't say how it's going to happen. He said the money would be for youth. Now, are we just talking about like police playing basketball with kids? Because that's not going to cut it, right? We need actual money for youth programs that work. And so my sense is people are going to stay in the streets till they get that. And that's different, is people saying, we're absolutely not going home until you change the way you're doing things.
Right.
You know, one of the many ways that police officers are promoted is, how many arrests have you made? How many tickets have you made? How many felonies have you gotten? Which, you know, encourages people to play fast and loose with the law. It encourages people to profile. And by people, I mean, including officers of color, right? There was a documentary that came out 1 or 2 years ago in New York about Black and Latino police officers who didn't want to participate in the numbers game and the stop and frisk, and they were punished internally by their supervising officers. And so even when you do have a police officer trying to do the right thing, under the current system that we have, the reward system is totally skewed against doing the right thing. It's in favor of being oppressive.
Yes, absolutely. Exactly. I'm not much of an eloquent speaker for a podcast host, and that's exactly what I thought. So wait, can we talk about prison reform? I heard the other day that, I mean, and not that we haven't touched on it a lot, but I've heard the other day that we're the only country that it's like we pay people to run prisons, and it's not run through the government. So it's like a for-profit prison, and then people have a quota to fill up those prisons. And I think that's insane.
Yeah. So we do have private prisons in the United States. Fortunately, we don't have any in New York, which is great. But there are a lot of private prisons throughout the country. And you're right. They're terribly incentivized because they make more money if they have more people locked up. So you'll see things like the companies behind private prisons pushing to make laws stricter and tougher and have sentences be longer, because then if somebody gets in trouble, they'll be a customer in their private prison system. And even in places like New York, where you don't have private prisons, we have lots of for-profit companies that profit off this, telephone companies, laundry companies. I mean, there's dozens and dozens of companies that make millions of dollars off their contracts with prisons. And, you know, the prisons, basically, the reason I got my People Not Prisons shirt here, the reality is that prisons don't achieve what they're supposed to, which is they're originally, you know, conceived of as a place for people to rehabilitate. We've lost track of that many decades ago. And yeah. So now what we do is we punish people, we send them to prison, maybe 2 years, maybe 5 years, maybe 20. And then they come home with basically a Metro card and a couple bucks in their pocket, and they're asked to go get your life back on track, go stay out of trouble, get an apartment, get a job. Meanwhile, we give people no help to do any of these things. Right. And then we expect the outcomes to be different. We're surprised when somebody winds up going back into the illegal economy because they can't find a job that will hire somebody with a felony record. So, right. So, you know, we have to really shift all that and figure out what the purpose is here. And so what do I talk about from my role as district attorney is if I see that somebody has broken the law out of a reason that is related to economic desperation or just, you know, being in a bind or struggling with something or making a mistake, we should figure out how do we get that person's life back on track, because that's better for everybody, right? I'll give an example, which is very common in I think much of the country, but definitely New York City, is there are people who are struggling with opioid addiction, and that's a very expensive addiction. And so people have taken to, you know, grabbing a couple things from Duane Reade to sell off to make money, right? And so what we have two basic options at that point. We can catch somebody, arrest them for shoplifting, and send them to Rikers Island for 3 months as punishment, and then expect the outcome to be different when they get out. Or we can say, look, it seems like you're struggling with an addiction. Is there a way you'd want to get treatment? And if we successfully get somebody through treatment, guess what? That's better for Duane Reade, because that person is not going to be coming by grabbing things. And so That's the kind of solutions that I think will make our society healthier and safer in the long run. And we have the tools. We know how to do this. Nothing that I'm saying is rocket science, right? But we have relied on prison for so long as the default answer that's where most police and prosecutors are comfortable.
Yeah. And I just feel like prison should be for actual bad people who do actual bad things instead of people who are racially profiled for, and then they, you know, are in jail for decades for a marijuana charge. And it's like people have marijuana stores. Like I've been to them in California, you know, it's just like, it makes no sense. And it's so fucked up. I mean, it's just, you know, it's just, it's insane. And how would someone, I've seen a lot of people say like, get rid, like free all the people who are incarcerated for petty crimes and for marijuana charges, because there's people on the, you know, it's legal in so many places now, you know, and how would we even go about that in the first place?
Yeah. So in New York, we are trying to legalize marijuana. It's still not legalized, right? We have medical marijuana, but should we legalize it? I think it would be important to make sure that we free anybody who's still there for those charges. But, you know, the drug war is the probably one of the most heinous things about our criminal justice policy. But just to go back to, you know, the question of bad people, right? I think even if somebody has done something that's really harmful, it's worth remembering, or I guess learning, for those who don't know, you know, the United States has the longest prison sentences in the world. And the sort of, we've all become very used to the idea of, you know, lock them up, throw them away. And, you know, lefties do this sometimes too, and it's people they don't like, right? If it's like Trump people or, you know, a police officer who does something bad or like a Wall Street crook, right? Now those people generally don't get caught or in trouble. So I'm not like crying tears for that category of people, But, you know, in general, we should be careful about seeking vengeance through long prison sentences, because at the end of the day, those policies end up hurting the Black community more than anybody else. And if you look around the world, you know, Europe, Japan, Canada, there's very rare to have a prison sentence longer than 15 or 20 years. I mean, even for murder, you know, in many of these countries, there's a maximum sentence length of 15, 17, 20 years. And the idea is, to get somebody acclimated to go back into society during that time. And right. so
treatment and help for whatever psychological issue they have.
Exactly. I mean, most people wind up in prison are dealing with serious trauma that may have started when they were a child, may have continued through their time as an adult. Mm-hmm. And you know, we are one of the only countries that have life sentences and have life sentences for even non-murder. Just we have life sentences for, you know, robbery and drugs and all kinds of things. And so we as a country really need to unpack that. And even when somebody does wind up in prison, there's really no reason that they should be there for decades. That doesn't serve us. It doesn't serve them. So yeah. that's just worth mentioning as well.
Yeah, definitely. No, definitely. I guess when I say bad people who do actually bad things, like I listen to a lot of true crime podcasts, uh-huh. You know, I think people, but then on the other side of that, there are serial killers who are insane, you know, or evil people, and pedophiles who are awful people. But on the other hand of that, there's people who get charged for crimes that they haven't done. They just blame it on the black people like that weren't even involved, you know? And I think that's something that has to be dealt with. And I know getting justice for those people has been on the rise more, but I don't know how would even.
Well, I can tell you how district attorney's office can do that.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, the Manhattan DA's office is one of several that has a conviction integrity unit, but it's very small and not very independent. So this is what I would do as Manhattan DA. I would take this unit and expand it significantly. And the idea here is traditionally, if somebody is trying to argue that they've been unjustly imprisoned, they can contact the district attorney's office and be like, hey, can you please take a look another look at my case? Most times today, they don't get the time of day, right?
Right.
But what
right.
we would do is staff up that department so that people can apply and have us take a look at their cases. And here's the important part. If we find questionable trends, because some of these convictions can go back to the 80s, the 90s, right? Well before anybody who's currently in the office was there. If we find out, for example, that the same detective is on the paperwork for three of these cases, that's a little bit suspicious. So now we start taking a look, you know, at all of the cases that this detective worked on. Maybe this is somebody who had a history of making things up. And by the way, this is based on a true story. What happened in Brooklyn? There was a detective who it turned out he had falsified information about at least 40 people who wound up in prison. So that's probably happening in everybody's jurisdiction watching this. There's probably at least, you know, one shady past or current police officer who may have done something similar. And so we would use our conviction integrity review unit to not only process claims coming at us, but also, you know, be on the lookout for where our office might have screwed up or cheated in the past.
Right. No, I mean, yeah, that'd be amazing. Would that be something that you would feel passionate about implementing?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, we've already talked about that. You know, it came up in the context of the Central Park Five, which, you know, was a Manhattan district attorney case. And
who a lot of men are protesting now. And I'm like, God.
I've gotten to meet a few of them, and they're great guys. And the reality is that, you know, the people who locked them away were highly respected prosecutors. And it just goes to show that, you know, first impressions can be deceiving. And I would take a look at, you know, what was going on in the sex crimes unit during that time period, because the Central Park Five were the most infamous or famous, but there may be other cases where people are still in prison under similar circumstances.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's when people say, I mean, that wasn't filmed, obviously. Like, you know, anything, any proof is why they went through so much hell. And probably even not why, I don't know, because people are racist. But I think when people say, like, you know, people are taking a stance now and people are noticing what's going on now because George Floyd's murder was filmed. And there's so many cases that go, like you said, like unfilmed, undocumented, you know, not noticed. And I think what you're saying is great, because there needs to be some systematic change, which is what you'll bring, which is good. Can you tell me about the 50A policy?
Yeah, definitely. So
I don't really know much about that, but I know a lot of people are trying to repeal it.
Yes. So there was a law passed in the 70s about the handling of personnel records for law enforcement. And with this, over the years, the meaning of it kind of evolved. But basically, the reality is now, after Eric Garner was killed in 2014, people wanted to know about, you know, who is the officer who killed him and what was his misconduct record. Mm-hmm. And the mayor said, we can't tell you because it's protected by 50A, which is the name of the provision of the law, right? And so there's been an effort ever since then. So we're talking 6 years now to, quote, repeal 50A. And that would basically allow for regular citizens, journalists, activists, to know the identity of people who are under investigation for misconduct and to know what actually happened in the cases, and know if those people have had previous, you know, histories of misconduct. So, look, on the one hand, this is going to be a good thing when this, I think as soon as this week, we could be seeing the law get repealed. That'll be a good thing because it means if you look at some of these horrific cases we've seen during the protests of people getting pepper sprayed and beaten, we'll be able to know who those officers are and what happens to them. I do want to, you know, not oversell this as the reform that's going to change policing because I remember before Eric Garner, we had slightly similar policies to the ones we're asking for now. And it's not like police were accountable then. I think ultimately the only way to really challenge police accountability is to reduce their power. And that means reducing their budget, reducing their influence on city government.
There's something like 38,000 police in New York City,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
That's insane and unnecessary, in my opinion. I mean, I don't know. So I'm looking through my questions here. And if there's anything else you wanted to touch on, please feel free.
Well, I do want to quickly mention, you know, you had asked at the beginning about what a district attorney can do. We've talked a lot about the criminal justice side of things. There's just a handful of other things that are worth mentioning because the office is, like I said, is meant to administer justice locally. And there are definitely people who are powerful who are not being held accountable under the current system. So some of the things we've talked about doing is going after employers who steal wages from their workers, the issue of wage theft, right? So there's more money actually taken from workers via wage theft than from all the other crimes of theft combined, like burglary, robbery, larceny. And so we want to make sure that there's a spotlight on employers who behave in that way, especially because their victims are often undocumented workers who are not going to be able to, you know, have a recourse to complain. Another example is there are certain landlords who behave badly in trying to get rid of their tenants, often because they're trying to replace somebody who's rent stabilized with somebody who might pay a lot more. So they might criminally harass their tenants. We want to make sure that our office is available to go after those types of folks. And then there's political corruption. You know, before I worked on the Closed Records campaign, I worked for the Moreland Commission to investigate public corruption. And I went after Republicans, Democrats, special interests. And the reality is in New York, there's plenty of corrupt Democrats. And we want to make sure that we're holding them accountable too. So the DA's office does handle the day-to-day street crime issues, but it also can tackle these bigger issues like I just mentioned. So I just want to throw that out there.
No, that's great. That's very important. I think I'm glad you did. I did have a question. How do judges relate to the DA office? And like, what is that correlation? Because I feel like a lot of us feel like the judges make the final decision, but does the district attorney like make the first decision? Like what happens there?
Because
I feel like I think there's a lot of corrupt judges that I've seen and a lot of racial profiling within that.
Yeah, that's a great question. So the district attorney's office does a lot to present, to a judge, and judges often follow the district attorney's recommendation. So for example, on this question of whether somebody should be held in jail pre-trial, it's technically the judge deciding based on a recommendation from the district attorney.
Okay.
In my experience, there are plenty of times where a district attorney will try to get somebody locked up pre-trial, and a more sympathetic judge will say, no, that's not right. It is pretty unlikely for a judge to ask somebody to be locked up in jail if the district attorney doesn't even ask for it, right? So, so having somebody at the DA's office is going to say, we're not going to seek bail for nonviolent felonies, will make it very unlikely that a judge will then do that, right? So that's one way that the judge and the DA's intersect. Now, it's very important to think about where judges come from, right? They're not like grown in a lab. You know, they're very often former prosecutors. Sometimes they're former defense attorneys. Sometimes they're just political appointees who don't have a lot of experience with either. And so you're right. There are some judges that are not very good. And by that, I mean, either not good at their jobs or in some cases corrupt. It varies a lot from place to place. And I think in the criminal justice movement, we've talked about this, that, 5 years ago, nobody was talking about electing progressive DAs. Now the next iteration, once we get some good district attorneys, will be to talk about judges. Let's get some good judges up there.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, I mean, if they make the final decision, I think that's extremely important. I mean, maybe I can get a judge on here, but I don't know if they would want to talk to me. I heard this is the first time I'm hearing there's a lot of new stuff that's coming my way with it, all of this, because I'm trying to be as involved as possible. And I this is the first time I've heard this Latin phrase. It seems Latin. I'm sure it's not. habeas corpus.
Uh-huh.
And yeah. They suspended it. And okay. Can you, yeah. Pretty sure I know what it entails, but could you explain for everybody what habeas corpus is? I think I'm saying that correctly.
You are. And this is a messy issue, but one I'm happy to talk about. Basically, the state is required to bring a charge against you that you've committed some crime if they're going to lock you up. It's a pretty basic tenet we all take for granted, right? That the state is not allowed to just say, I don't like what you're saying, what you're doing, so we're going to lock you up, right? And if you are going to be detained, the state has a certain amount of time to bring some kind of charge against you. And in New York, it's 24 hours you can be held without having your charges arraigned in front of a judge. The problem is they've arrested so many people, and we've got this whole COVID virtual courtroom thing going on where judges are videoing in, that right. Things were going very slowly. And so the police asked, can we suspend this 24-hour law during the protests? And the judge said, yes. And people were very outraged about that. And, it took me until the next morning where I started reading about the case and looking up the judge. And it hit me that in the reporting, what a lot of people had not said is this judge, Judge Burke, is a former prosecutor. He was a Manhattan assistant district attorney for 12 years. He was appointed to the bench by Rudy Giuliani, who we all know is like a feverish pro-cop, anti-protester type. And then he was reappointed by Mayor Bloomberg. So on the one hand, it's like, how could a judge have done such a thing? On the other hand, it's like, not that crazy that this judge did. And this goes back to your very last question. Who are these people, right? This is a former prosecutor appointed by Mayor Giuliani. And as judge, he's acting like it. And so,
Wow, fuck. That's so fucking annoying.
Yeah. And now, so my hope is that, as the number of people in jail come down, I mean, he doesn't have the authority by himself to suspend habeas corpus. So it's more like he gave temporary permission to hold people longer than 24 hours. My hope is that we quickly move past and get out of that. But I don't know if the decision is going to be appealed, but, it was a very troubling result, and it just goes to show the importance of organizing so that, we had Mayor Giuliani in charge of the city for 8 years, Mayor Bloomberg in charge for 12. So that's 20 years of appointments in government agencies, judgeships. All the people running the police department now came up under Giuliani and Bloomberg. So, elections have consequences. We're still dealing with the aftermath of all the decisions that those two guys made for so many years.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I've seen a lot of people say like, you want systemic change from the same people who brought you the, systemic racism. And I'm like, well, yes, of course it seems crazy, but I feel like talking to people like you who want everything that we want, but can run for office is so important. And people like AOC are so important that actually want change for people and not money and greed and
Yeah, and we have so many great people running. I mean, you know, there's an election this June 23rd. There's a number of great people running for state Senate and state assembly.
You know, you're not in the election, correct?
No, I'm next spring. And okay. Next spring, I'll be on the, you know, on the ballot with a ton of really great people running for New York City Council. And, you know, 50 of us just put out a defund the NYPD letter, me and 49 other people running for office next year. So,
wow.
I mean, you know, not all of those folks are going to win, but heck, if even like some of them win, we're going to have a really bold city council moving forward. And, my response to people who, you know, are skeptical or cynical about systemic changes, we have to do all of the above. We have to protest in the street. We have to do long-term organizing, right? There's people who have to be ready to be in this for the long haul, not 2 weeks or a month, but like years, because let's say we get to defund the NYPD. Guess when that battle is going to happen? Next year's budget, the year after that's budget, right? So we need to build structures that can fight for these things over the course of many years. And then, yes, we have to engage the political side. It's like the inside-outside game. You need to have both.
And yeah, definitely. I mean, yeah, voting matters, you know, that's what I definitely want to get through to the audience too, is that voting in every, and I didn't understand this either for a long time, I guess, because I guess just me, like everybody else, I didn't really get political until Trump was in office, you know, and then all you're thinking is about the head guys, but how much change can they bring locally to where you're at? And I think like within each state, if each progressive movement is moved in towards the right way or whatever you want, you know, in every state, I think that is what brings the real change into one unit, right? United States.
Absolutely. And also, you know, for those of you who are listening who are lefties or liberals, you know, we have a Democratic Manhattan DA, a Democratic mayor, and a Democrat governor, and they've all let us down and failed us, right? So that's on us, right? We need to own the fact that, yeah, Trump is the worst, but this is not all his fault. This is also the fault of people in the Democratic Party who have let down communities for years.
Absolutely. And I've seen a lot of, and I know this is going to kill my very Democratic liberal mother, but I've heard a lot of people say Democrat and Democrat and Republican are kind of two in the same sometimes, you know, and I don't know how real that is, but I think a more progressive movement can bring more change.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a lifelong Democrat and I'm of the mind. I'm a left-wing Democrat, right? So I see every primary as a chance for us to shift the party. I think the difference is, you know, the Democratic politicians feel the heat. They feel pressure from people protesting out in the streets in a way that Republicans don't, because they know that we're not aligned, right? And so I think with people, you know, with what the moment we have going on now, almost every big city in the country is controlled by a Democratic mayor. Now is the time to exert maximum pressure and just keep the pressure on until they make big changes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, that's why I was so excited about Bernie Sanders and like everything he was bringing to his campaign. And I still am, and I still love him. He is my hero. But I mean, I think why people are saying Democrat and Republican can be two in the same is because we haven't seen the change that we want, even though, you know, I don't know. Oh, gosh. Yeah, I'm seeing a lot of questions that have been answered. Why does the NYPD not have an oversight when it comes to their intelligence budget? I'm not really sure what he means by that, but I'm sure you can understand that.
Yeah, that was probably in relation to a story that came out this morning that said they don't have an oversight with relation to their intelligence budget. You know, in the midst of this budget fight, it's been clear that the NYPD has entire pockets of money that we, the public, don't really know. And I got to tell you, as somebody who has been coordinating around this defund the NYPD stuff, it is very difficult to get good information about how the NYPD spends its money and, you know, what kind of contracts it has. So we just learned today that they have all kinds of intelligence tools, which is basically, you know, military level spyware, right? That is not really accounted for. And I don't know what the answer should be. You know, it's It should theoretically be the city council. They haven't historically done a very good job holding the NYPD accountable. Maybe that'll change moving forward. I will say as district attorney, I will be surely keeping an eye on any infringement of civil liberties by the NYPD. That's part of what I've been doing my whole career. One of the first things I worked on as a civil rights lawyer is taking on this very issue of NYPD intelligence gathering. If I can tell like a very quick story about it, but basically it was called, they had this thing called Operation Lucky Bag, where they would take a designer bag, just like the thing you would shop in, right? And they would put it in random places in public. And if a person picked it up, they would arrest the person on the grounds that the kind of person who picks up a nice bag that isn't theirs probably has a criminal record.
Oh my God.
And it was a completely illegal practice. You're not allowed to do that. And we had to basically sue, and we found, you know, like a diner owner and a doctor and a banker, all people who were just like trying to do the right thing, returning a bag to its proper owner who got arrested along the way. And it just goes to show they were doing this because they were trying to build a database of people who they thought were possibly criminals, even though they hadn't broken any laws. And this so, is that
I was like that, I pick up the bag and be like, oh, let's find out whose this is, and
exactly.
Then I get like, what
exactly? And this is 11 years ago. Their sophistication has gotten way higher around technology and online tracking and cameras all over the city. So It's very disturbing. And this is again, we're back at the same place we were before. This is why the NYPD has to be taken down a notch in terms of its power, in terms of its funding, because you can pass some reform tweaks, but if you're just going to learn, you know, out of nowhere that they have a huge intelligence budget with no accountability, that just shows that they've grown way too powerful and unaccountable.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, how are your feelings on one case that disturbs me, especially, I mean, every case disturbs me about, I mean, in this Black Lives Matter movement. I can't even say especially because they're all on the same level now that I'm thinking about it. But the Breonna Taylor case, her being in her own home, they got the wrong black person. Like, that's insane. And like Sandra Bland, like people like that, like, what are we going to do about these people? Like Breonna Taylor, from what I know, I could be wrong, but from what I know, Breonna Taylor's murderers are still on active duty. So like, what can we do, and what can if you got elected, what could you do about making the police force accountable for their actions? And like, of course we have to defund and do everything from the top, but.
Well, so this is something district attorneys could technically do. In fact, in almost every of these cases, all the say their name cases, the district attorneys locally do have the power to act. In some cases they did, like, In George Floyd's case, very reluctantly, I might add, the Minneapolis prosecutor did take action. And then, of course, they turned it over to Keith Ellison to manage it. This is sort of a problem around the country where district attorney's offices are historically so close to their local police departments that there is a skepticism among the community that the DA will actually be able to go after the police. In Breonna Taylor's case, they have not arrested and brought charges, right? So there's a couple ways you can solve this. You can ask for a special prosecutor, right? You can ask, for example, the state attorney general to investigate a case when you don't think you can trust the local DA. I'm explicitly running on a platform that includes police accountability. And the way I'm going to handle it is I'm going to have a special unit within the prosecutor's office that only handles police misconduct cases. So they are not going to be friendly chatting it up with the police on a day-to-day basis, which is the problem, right? In a lot of departments, like, well, we work with these guys. We're doing cases with them. How could we really prosecute them? Well, in our office, we're going to have a unit that is not buddy-buddy with them. They're not going to go out for drinks with them after work. It's going to be their job to do police accountability. And so the police are going to dislike them, but they're going to be doing their jobs. And they're going to, if we had a situation like Breonna Taylor or George Floyd in New York, under my watch in Manhattan, we would have this unit able to go after them right away.
Yeah, I mean, Eric Garner's case was in New York, right?
Staten Island. So Staten New York Island. City. So Staten Island has its own district attorney.
Okay. Do we know if they were held accountable at all?
They were not. The Staten Island district attorney at the time declined to bring charges forward.
Okay. I mean, all right. Well, I mean, everything you're saying is exactly what I wanted to hear when it comes to like trying to vote for district attorney. Like I just recently found out even what a district attorney was, and even more so now. And I think it's so important to have to have this vote, especially for people who are more progressive. And I just want to touch on more things surrounding your vote now, because we're nearing an hour. So why do you feel like you're qualified? And I think you are, but to tell the audience, why do you think you're qualified for this job? And then how do you feel about the current district attorney? I can't remember his name. I know it starts with a C.
Yeah, Sy Vance. Yeah. So again, I said this a little bit at the beginning, but I've spent my career trying to reform the criminal justice system from a variety of different angles, as an attorney, as somebody who's worked in government, somebody who's worked outside of government, someone who's worked on big systems change, like closing Rikers. And I think all of those things are really important experiences to have if you're going to come into the district attorney's office and try to shake things up. We are going to face a lot of opposition from the police, but also from other sort of conservative elements of law enforcement, from the New York Post. This change is going to be hard. So we really need somebody in that office who not only is committed to the right things, and hopefully people listening think what I'm saying are the right things, but even if you agree with that, we're going to need somebody with political experience to try to get this done, because it's going to be very hard. And we're going to have to make sure that, just like people are doing now in the streets, that we're building a coalition that can support each of these changes. And I think I'm the best qualified candidate to do that. You know, the incumbent Sy Vance is somebody who has made a career of going very harshly after low-income communities of color and looking the other way when powerful people are in front of him, from Jeffrey Epstein to Harvey Weinstein to the Trump children. And that's, we're trying to flip that around. We're trying to give people who have never been given an opportunity in their communities a second chance, a way to get their lives back on track, while at the same time holding powerful interests accountable in the way that they haven't been before.
That's great. And so, is what the current? I've heard not great things about the current district attorney.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you feel about how he's running his position?
Yeah. I mean, it's terrible. It's been a terrible 11 years. I mean, from the very beginning. I mean, the most recent thing is he's trying to, get the governor to change the law to make it easier to imprison people during this protest. And, there's a horrific case that happened last year where it came out that a Columbia University affiliated doctor, somebody who's very prominent, had sexually assaulted as many as 40 or 50 of his patients. And we only learned this because some of the women very bravely came forward and blew the whistle on the fact that the DA's office had more than 20 of their statements about what happened to them, and ended up giving the doctor a slap on the wrist, no jail time, no prison time. And it was because he was connected to a powerful institution like Columbia. That's the only conceivable excuse for it. And I mean, it's either corruption or incompetence, but I'm thinking in this case, more likely corruption. And we've just had enough of that. We've had enough of rich and powerful people getting away with things when they're in the criminal legal system. But somebody else who doesn't have those opportunities makes a mistake, and they may face multiple years in an upstate prison. We've seen 3 terms of that from Sy Vance, and so we're trying to deny him a 4th term.
Wow, that's crazy. And yeah, I mean, I could have a whole other hour talking about how women have been mistreated and especially Black women have been mistreated in the police system, justice system. But we don't have another hour unless you're always welcome to come back on.
I'd love to come back sometime, sure.
Yeah, that'd be great. And so when can we vote for you?
So the election's not until next spring in New York. It's going to be a year from now. But people can go to janos4da.com to learn more about the campaign. You can learn about our issues. You can sign up to volunteer. You can donate anything that you'd like to do to support the campaign. In the moment, you know, we both me and my campaign team, we all come from the criminal justice movement and from organizing. So we always try to, in addition to advance our own campaign, support what's going on. So before this, we really focused on mutual aid, getting people out of prison who might be at risk of COVID, like elderly people. And so in this moment, we're very, very focused on getting that NYPD budget reduced. So if people want to join us, we have a day of action coming up tomorrow, and you can go on janos4da.com and check it out. And during that day of action, we're going to be contacting our city council members and getting them on the record for whether they support $1 billion in NYPD budget cuts. So that's one way people can get involved right away.
Okay, awesome. So that's June 9th, right? Or June 10th. What day is
June, it? Today's the 8th, so June 9th.
Okay, great. I'll post that on my social media because this probably will come out in about a week. I mean, I feel like there's so many things that I probably didn't get to cover, but I think we covered a lot. Like, I remember looking at the clock and it was about 20 minutes and I was like, oh my gosh, what am I even going to say anymore? There's so much to be covered and there's so much racial injustice right now. And I do think that the protests are doing a lot, and I commend you for going to those protests and being a part of it, because people like you is really what, brings change and helps bring change and that and helps bring validity to these protests, and brings action. And I'm just, feeling very passionate right now. I think a lot of people are.
Yes, you should. And people should go out there and protest. If they don't feel comfortable doing it for health or whatever reasons, there's so much you can do online as well, calling your legislators, being active on Twitter. And so people can follow me at Janos Martin on Twitter if they like. But yeah, this is the moment to lead in. We're so close to getting really big changes. So I just hope we stick to it.
Amazing. Yes. Okay, cool. So, all right. And there's anything else you want to mention? There's anything else going on that you'd want to promote or you feel comfortable?
I think there's plenty going on, but if people want to learn more about criminal justice reform, again, they can go to our website, sign up for email, because there's a lot to unpack about what's broken about the criminal justice system. And I'm glad policing is getting this much attention now, but a lot of changes have to come to how we prosecute people and how we use our jails and prisons. And that's maybe hopefully the next thing we can tackle once we get some real police reform in this country.
Amazing. Okay, cool. I think we're good. I feel good about this. All right. So I'm going to say goodbye to my sound guy, Will. He likes a finite goodbye. Thank you, everybody. Love you. Bye.
Thank you. Take care.